From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And hey, if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
This morning we speak first with Christopher Larkin. He's the Chief Technology Officer at Concord Technologies, where commitment to machine learning has allowed him to drive real-world solutions that improve the delivery of healthcare. He joins the show to talk about this and also to talk about the IT predictions for 2022. Will workers stay remote? Will cyber threats come under control or take a darker turn? Larkin's professional world revolves around him being at the bleeding edge of answering these questions.
And then Eric Johnson, a leader in decision-making research, who has written a new book about the science of decision-making, The Elements of Choice, Why the Way We Decide Matters. And every time we make a choice, our minds go through an elaborate process most of us never even notice. Johnson shares the inner workings of how we decide, something most of us know nothing about, though we make decisions every second of every day.
These two guests, plus a little chat about the James Webb Telescope, when we think it might be launching Christmas Day, and where it's launching from.
Our guest, Chris Larkin, is the Chief Technology Officer at Concord Technologies, where commitment to machine learning has allowed him to drive real-world solutions that improve the delivery of healthcare. He joins the show to talk about IT predictions for 2022. What can we expect for cybersecurity? How will social media affect our lives and privacy? We might expect better data privacy protection, but will we get it? And how does this all tie into healthcare? Chris Larkin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thank you, John. I appreciate that. And hi, Lynn. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. We're great here in Park City. It's a snowy morning.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, it's good
it's
to have you
here in Seattle. So,
Go figure. Okay. So it's really good to have you on the program. This is something we're very interested in talking about. It's really hard to believe that we are entering our third year of COVID, and there have been many challenges, many hardships. Many people have lost their lives, and many loved ones remain. And it's been hard for a lot of people, but there have been a couple of little nuggets of gold out there. I think we've learned that telemedicine can work under certain situations. And one of the other things we learned is that, you know, for better or for worse, we can be somewhat productive in Zoom meetings once we, you know, get some experience with all of it. How does that tie into some of your predictions?
That's good question. Especially in Seattle, we've got titans of industries in IT. And what we found out was really interesting as the pandemic progressed, which is the attraction of talent to, let's say, an Amazon or a Google or a Microsoft became fluid based upon how they were office-centric, or were they home-centric, or was there a hybrid going on? And so it became very interesting as one would come out and say, we expect to return to the office in, let's say, September of 2020. The next day, the other large company would say, that's interesting, we are going to postpone returning to the office for another 9 months. And what you saw is like this liquidity of talent move to the more hybrid or more home situation. So the actual movement of talent between tech players was very interesting, especially in this town, over the course of the pandemic. So who stays home and who goes to work became a very interesting, if not competitive, distinction for the different companies. So that was one thing that we observed. And what that begins to tell us is, for a prediction of the future, is that people will stay home to work, especially in the technology trade. In our businesses, though, we have not only technology, but we have healthcare and healthcare data. So it poses a little bit of an issue when we start moving things like healthcare data to a home for somebody, a data scientist, let's say, to evaluate. And that could pose some problems for people working at home managing data and healthcare data. So we have to take extra care then as professionals working from home to make sure we are secure at the home as we are in the office. So that's the, and the big prediction there is that we're gonna stay home or at least stay hybrid. And by hybrid, I mean, some of the time we'll be in the office to do design-like activities, team-like activities, but a lot of the time we'll be in our home offices.
And something that has nothing to do with the actual meetings that we're having remotely, the actual physicalness of being in another location, but something that I'm really curious about, and we probably won't know for maybe 5 or 10 years, and that's the fostering of creativity. When you're sitting around a table with people and you're picking up energy from everyone and all sorts of visual cues that you're not necessarily picking up on a flat screen Zoom where the audio is not very good, and you're not able to pick up all that. What will creativity look like compared to real meetings in the future as we get more data? And I don't think anyone's really been talking about that, but maybe they have.
We have. So we talk a lot at Concord about what are the types of activities where we want to all be in front of the same whiteboard in the same room and pick up on those, and what sorts of activities, design especially, can we all be separate for. Status meetings, we can all be at home sipping coffee in our fuzzy slippers for status meetings. But when we really need to create, we tend to try to come into the office. We can create via Zoom, but it takes a different level of skill, mostly in communication, not creativity. So you're, as a leader of that meeting, you have to be able to look at people's facial expressions. You have to see whether they're engaged or not, and then pull them out, verbally, get them to actually speak. So you have to pay more attention and a little bit different level of skill to really draw out everybody on the meeting. Those facial expressions are really important, especially when dealing with important technology. So it is a different set of tools and a different set of skills that we need to be creative in a Zoom meeting.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Christopher Larkin. He's the Chief Technology Officer at Concord Technologies, based in Seattle. And Chris, I have to say, I read somewhere the weather report for Seattle over the next week and a half. It said it was supposed to snow 8 out of 10 days in Seattle. And this plays back into working remotely. Seattle freezes up as a city. It closes down as a city when it snows because it's hilly and you don't have the sort of infrastructure to deal with it like we have here. So that remote, With large weather events like we're starting to see more and more, that also lends itself to working remotely. And I'm wondering about, maybe in a town like Park City, we're kind of hybrid more now with remote versus being in the office. But I know like big technology companies like Amazon, they're like pretty much 100% remote at this point. Is that how it is in all these hotbeds of technology?
It is right now, just because when we ask somebody to come into the office, or when we go into the office as leaders, we will draw people to us. So what we don't want to do is endanger our own workforce by bringing them into the office for a meeting that's not critical. So there's actually a lot of safety pandemic-wise by keeping people separate. The odds are less that we'll take out a whole team by having a meeting that turns into a super spreader event. So we want to be very careful about that. So it's a good defense mechanism to have people from home. But your point is a good one, which is everybody's home and everybody's neighborhood doesn't have the infrastructure maybe that Park City does. And so if the power goes out at my house, I have to have, which it does about once or twice a year, I have to be able to withstand that. Maybe that's going down to Starbucks down the block, or maybe it's me turning on my generator. But from that standpoint, there's got to be a plan. So if we think about a disaster recovery plan or a business resumption plan, in the past we've thought of it as, will our building or will our data center be able to survive a power outage? Now we're actually having to think about, will my house be able to survive a power outage? And how will I be able to work from home if I lose power? So that's a really, really interesting point. And it's a key to being able to continue this hybrid or this work from home scenario.
Yeah, well, data privacy is probably, you know, especially for healthcare technologies, has to be sort of number one priority, right? Because it's the privacy element is so important. What are your biggest challenges? You mentioned that, you know, remote working is a challenge because we don't know how secure those things are. But, it, you know, as we look into 2022, how is the healthcare how are healthcare technology companies dealing with this?
Yeah, so more and more we are moving in data privacy to be able to certify certain companies, certain organizations as having the infrastructure and processes in place to really protect my data, your data, our family's data in terms of healthcare. That's one way that we're dealing with it. I do believe, getting back to predictions, I do believe that we're, as a society, both the U.S. and certainly North America, as Europe has, we've gotten much more strict upon our certifications and our ability to maintain the privacy of an individual, especially in healthcare. You know, the challenge with healthcare data is the bad guys really like health records. And the bad guys really like health records because they are rich with personal information. And so that's why when we are working with health data, we take extra precautions. And those precautions really are making sure that we're encrypting data in motion and taking care of data at rest. And more than that, that we actually have what we call eyes on glass, which is we have teams of people watching monitors to make sure that has any pattern changed. And then we combine that with artificial intelligence, which is looking for minute changes in patterns of who's accessing the data. And when both our eyes on glass teams and our artificial intelligence are both looking at data that's moving across the wire or that it's in a data center, then we're really, folks, we're using the best tools that we can, both machine tools and people, to be able to do that. The one thing that is really important, though, when you're working with health and healthcare data, is to stay humble, because what you achieve today from privacy and data protection may not work tomorrow. In other words, we are in a race with bad guys, and the race advances every day. So we have to stay up with our tools and our deployment of patches for different operating systems. And it is a full-time, never-ending job to stay up with the bad guys, because they are relentless. So
they certainly are. You know, when we hear about technology, when people hear about technology, maybe something grabs their attention. They say, man, I want that. That's exactly what I want. But what a lot of people don't understand is that there are legacy systems out there, and I think healthcare is certainly one of them, where they've been in hard copy for so long, and that is probably where your company began, being able That's to right. take this hard copy and these facsimile systems and to get them into the digital world. Can you talk about legacy systems and making the move to digital?
Yeah, so legacy systems have really quarantined or segmented healthcare records for a long, long time, such that they made it very difficult for a record to follow me unless I want to print out dozens, maybe hundreds of pages of what my health record is. So as we begin to unify these legacy systems or be able to create what's liquidity of data, so be able to pull health records out and move it to where we need it to go, we are now looking at technologies like Concord, where we can create a document from a legacy system and then use machine learning to read that document, pull out key information out of that document, and deliver that story to a new healthcare provider before the document ever gets there. In other words, be able to pull out a word like COVID or a word like cancer or a word, another C word, cardiac, and which tells the provider what to look out for and actually who to create an appointment for me with. So we can now begin to do that with AI by in terms of reading these legacy documents coming from these systems that you talked about.
Yeah, and we're just scratching the surface here. So for our listeners who would be interested in learning more, go to concord.net, and in on that website, you can navigate and find some ebooks and white papers at no cost. One is The Evolution of Digital Communication Strategies, Optimizing Payer and Provider Communication. One is Moving from On-Premise Cloud Fax, A Comparison of Cost and Network Architecture white papers. So yeah, you've got some pretty good resources on there for people to take a peek and learn more about it. So that's pretty good.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. What is the one question that you have about cybersecurity that you would like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
So the one question with regard to cybersecurity is a lot of the information and data now that's coming off of our phones, that's coming off of our watches, coming off of our Peloton machines, you know, how this all begins to get unified for the consumer is really going to be a powerful question in the future, because as machine learning continues to accelerate, I want a simple question. I want to see if there's anything wrong with me by the cardiac information coming off of my watch or by my sleep. It's being measured. So that question that consumers will have, I'm sure in the next several years, which is, hey, you're gathering all this data on me, you being different companies. What's wrong with me? Is there anything wrong with me, or am I healthy? And so really I'm beginning to understand that, because the answer is somewhere in that data, if I'm healthy or there may be something wrong with me. Putting it together for healthcare is going to be both a challenge and an opportunity on whoever can do that. But the machine learning capability, if it's not there already, it will be there soon to put together a single view of Christopher Larkin. And so from that standpoint, that's going to be very interesting to see how that happens.
Christopher, it seems like on the one hand, some of us would like that. I mean, we've got our Apple Watch, we've got our, you know, Strava recording our workouts, we've got, you know, maybe another app recording what we've eaten, and all this aggregation of data can, you know, like you say, come out with a, well, I think you're about this healthy, or yeah, I think you need to work out more, or it looks like you need to cut back on your salt and, you know, sugar and alcohol. But that's also very scary. And it's very scary to a lot of us. And how do we as consumers, I mean, this is one of the things that you work on at Concord Technologies, right, is to really create a feel for your consumers of safety and security and privacy.
That's right. So if you look at the latest California acts on privacy, what was in Europe, which is my ability to be forgotten, my right to be forgotten, is now coming. And California is the first state that's really passed legislation that says, I need to be notified as a consumer if you are making money or getting revenue based upon my data. So I need to be able to opt in or opt out of that. So I really think that as consumers and as patients and healthcare consumers, we need to understand who's using our data, and we need to have the right to either opt in or opt out of that, and even participate in the revenue if you're selling my data. So I think that those are some of the big questions. Now that doesn't address the scary part of it, which is the more of my data that gets consolidated, the more answers may be for me, but also the more easily accessible my information and data may become. So knowing who has my data is and how they are taking care of it, whether it's big tech or some small application on your cell phone, that is going to be really critical moving forward. Who has it? What are they doing with it? So I'm actually supportive of legislation that gives power to the consumer over their own records and health records. So,
Well, that's good to hear. So you talk a little bit about predictions for social media and how social media will become more focused on security and privacy, even our conversations, and how there will be limits on machine learning in terms of, I don't know, even, just an example. So the other day I'm on LL Bean site looking for some holiday gifts for my parents. And of course, everyone knows that this happens, right? Then suddenly you go onto Facebook, and now I'm noticing even Nextdoor, which is, you know, is a website. Now they've got it figured out that I've been looking on LL Bean, and they're giving me all of this new advertising that wasn't there before I hopped on that. What can you say about regulating that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think there's two things. One, as consumers, we will increasingly demand to know the hows. Okay, how did you arrive at that ad? How did you find me? So I think that that's going to be coming. And I will make choices as a consumer based upon who I trust, not just who has the nicest LL Bean snow boots. So it's who is most trustworthy and who is answering my questions the best. I will say that there's also this generation, Generation Z, Generation X, have also begun to take stance in terms of who they not only participate in with as a consumer, but also who they invest in. And I think that sends a strong message. I will tell you that I have a granddaughter, and her image has never made it out to social media or any elements of her identity. Her parents, my son and daughter-in-law, have taken steps to make sure that pictures and data and information about her have not made it to social media. I think that that's just one example of how this next generation is going to begin taking additional care of their image, their identities online. So,
here in Utah, we have an organization called Intermountain Health, and they've done a pretty good job as they've brought in new practices under the umbrella of Intermountain, of digitizing all the records and those sorts of things. They also have an app called My Health, which I've found to be a pretty good app. I mean, I got a blood test, and I got an email from my doctor the next day saying everything looks good, and then I could go to My Health, and I could take a look at all the various pieces in the blood panel compared to last year and the year before and the year before that. I'm curious, what percentage of folks or health organizations have gotten to that point?
So Intermountain Health is a great institution. They have a wonderful reputation. Everyone that I choose to work with has apps. And you will recognize this, though. So I would say a large percentage of, whether it's in New York with New York Presbyterian or Intermountain Health, or in Seattle, I have Virginia Mason, and I have my Virginia Mason applications. Now, one one provider acquired my provider of healthcare, but they have two different apps, and now I have two different records on two different hospitals in the application. So I have to figure out who I'm seeing and why I'm seeing them, and use a singular application for that provider. So the more applications, the more need for secure integration between the applications. But it's pretty good. And as consumers who are used to dialing up iTunes and Amazon on our phone, we are bringing that same demand to healthcare. And we expect a lot more from our healthcare institutions in terms of providing that that type of communication with our healthcare providers.
People used to wear bracelets that said maybe what their blood type was, or if they needed insulin, or, you know, those sorts of things in the event that they were in an accident and they were unconscious and someone came upon them. What is the technological solution for the future for people that would like to be able to very quickly be able to communicate to the healthcare professional, to someone that shows up in an ambulance at an accident site, exactly what they may be allergic to, their blood type, all the different pieces that would help them make informed decisions?
Yeah, so a break the glass scenario with my health record, my health information on my cell phone. Mobile phones are so pervasive that it's a great opportunity for a registered healthcare worker who maybe, I do a lot of running, so what, I hope this never happens, but someday I'm unconscious on the side of the road. I would love to have a healthcare worker be able to break the glass on my cell phone, in other words, enter in a standard code, and be able to see all my relevant health history and health information. That's where this is going. And so obviously that kind of power comes a lot of control. So I can definitely see that happen though.
Right. You know, I was thinking about something that you said earlier about people getting all this data from their watches and from their phones and you know, all these different pieces of input that they have, and they're trying to make decisions. They must be driving their doctors crazy if they have a cardiologist and they get a certain report that, you know, they only got so much REM sleep and their heart's palpitating. And I mean, we have to somehow protect our healthcare workers from being inundated with a bunch of people who are getting data 24/7.
Yeah, so that's right. There's a famous phrase that a patient uses now that healthcare workers have come to expect, and that's, "Hey, I just Googled this and dot dot dot." Right, and so it's become, and so there's real talent in the way that you deal with that. My general practitioner, and I have a good relationship, and she will say, "You know, Chris, I've read the data and the data doesn't support what you're saying." You know, because I'll just pull something off of Google and say, "What do you think about this?" And she said, "The data doesn't support it." But that means that she's keeping up too. So from that standpoint, there's a lot of talent right now in the healthcare provider ranks to be able to deal with that. "I've just Googled this and dot, dot, dot." So,
It's very interesting. Chris, I wanted to ask you, I've been sitting here thinking as you've been talking about this. It was an interview that John and I did a handful of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, and it was a startup at the time called CrowdMed. And what that is a crowdsourcing platform for, you know, doing what we do. If we Google, you know, "I have these symptoms," but this is an actual platform where all of your symptoms go out to healthcare professionals, maybe not just physicians, but they could be homeopathic, you know, practitioners or PAs or whoever. And it aggregates all these symptoms and the diagnostics, and then comes back to you, and apparently, you know, lots of high success for actually diagnosing these, you know, mysterious medical conditions. And I don't know if you've heard of something like that, but I'm kind of curious about what someone like you would think of that.
My first thoughts are around accountability for the diagnosis.
Exactly. So
when I go to my doctor and we have deep conversations about what my a symptom may be, and then they come back with a set of diagnoses. It might be this. It may be heart palpitations. But you may have also drinking too much coffee this morning.
You know,
something like that. So there's that kind of conversation and back and forth that has to take place. I have a little bit of fear and trepidation that when we just Google a couple of symptoms and it comes back with a diagnosis, that tends to be pretty shallow. It may indeed lead me on the right course, but it also may lead me and cost me days, maybe even weeks or months of doing that and not getting the proper diagnosis. So I would always default to being able to go talk with a real healthcare provider.
Christopher Larkin is the Chief Technology Officer at Concord Technologies. And again, if you'd like to dig a little deeper into this, go to concord.net, and they have some white papers and some ebooks there to help you understand some of the solutions that they provide and some of the questions you should be asking. And Christopher, we just want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, yeah, it's been fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing a little bit of the snow, not a lot of the snow that Lynn, you described. So,
good luck with that Seattle snow.
All right, thank you, and happy holidays to you both, and thank you for having me.
Yes, okay, thank you for joining us.
And to you too, all Chris. Right. Thank you.
And we just wanted to talk briefly before our next interview about the James Webb Space Telescope. We know that due to bad weather and high winds at the launch site in French Guiana, it will be launching now, we think, on Christmas Day. So we have something other than presents to open on Christmas Day. Got to tune into that.
We've been waiting so long for this telescope, and Hubble's been a game changer. Its 30-year anniversary was 2 years ago, and it's done so much to push science education forward. This new device, this new space telescope, is going to be demonstrably more powerful, and the Hubble sits only a couple hundred miles off of planet Earth. And has all sorts of interference when it has its infrared information package going. The new telescope, James Webb, is going to be a million miles away and is not going to have any of that interference. So we're expecting big things from James Webb.
That's right. This is big. So Christmas Day, everyone tune in to that launch. Now, every time we make a choice, our minds go through an elaborate process most of us never even notice. Every choice that we make was actually designed by someone else. From the sandwich we order to the ski pass we decide to buy, the science of decision-making shows up in every aspect of our lives. We ourselves are also the architects of choice without even knowing it. Joining us now is Eric Johnson. He's the director of the Center for Decision Sciences at Columbia Business School. His new book is called The Elements of Choice: Why the Way We Decide Matters. Eric Johnson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, very glad to be here.
Who knew that there is a Center for Decision Sciences at Columbia Business School? Sometimes you hear these things and you say, wow, this is something I never would have thought of. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's pretty simple. I mean, decision-making is so important to every business decision, and yet it's something that until the last 20 years, people have not studied systematically. So one of the things that we try to do is understand how two kinds of people, what I call designers, the people who actually present choices to other people, and the other folks, choosers, the people who are making choices. So to use an example you used, Lynn, you walk into a restaurant, there is a menu there. Somebody has designed that menu and made lots of choices for you before you ever see it. And then there's the choosers who are there deciding what to eat.
So your new book is, who is your target audience? Is it the choosers or the decision makers, or excuse me, the choosers or the designers Or both? I would assume it's both.
Well, primarily because we're all designers. It's for everybody. Mm-hmm. Because although I talk about restaurants or talk about websites, you also present choices to people around you. One of my favorite examples is a friend, when he first found out I was working this, talked about his three-year-old daughter in bedtime. There's a crisis. You know, do you want to go to bed or not? And I think parents have probably figured out this trick themselves. He changed the choice framing the way it was supposed to. Do you want to bounce into bed or do you want to fly into bed? And instantaneously, bedtime became much less of a problem. And so the bottom line is it's both, but basically for designers, because we're also designers as well as choosers.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Eric Johnson. He's written The Elements of Choice, Why the Way We Decide Matters. I found this fascinating in your book when you said that most people don't think design architecture affects them. Can you talk about that?
Sure. One of the things is just ask yourself, last time you've made a serious choice, picking the ski pass, for example, did you think about how they structured the options, how many options they gave you? It's hard to think about that at the same time you're making a choice. So we walk down supermarket aisles trying to buy spaghetti sauce, spaghetti. We don't think about why are certain brands here and other brands there. It turns out, of course, there's a whole science to placement in supermarkets, but it's not something we think about. And so when you ask people about were they affected, they'll say no, even though we know because we're watching their choices, they were affected.
Yeah. And since I heard about your book and I took a peek at it last week, before we started getting ready for this particular interview, everywhere I went, I started thinking about this. And you become very sensitive about it. And when you're online, when you're driving in your car, when you're walking through the airport, I mean, it's really a big science, behind this. And as Lynn said, we're probably, being introduced to this for the first one. Well, not the first time, but we're really, becoming more sensitive to it. And it's just fascinating.
Well, thanks. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because not everybody knows what psychologists and marketers and other folks know.
Eric, I know that you maybe you have been faced with which ski pass to buy this year, but I will tell you, it's something that people in Park City talk about. Which pass did you get? Did you get the Epic? Did you get the Icon? Did you get the Mountain Collective? Or did you just get an individual season's pass? And the funny thing is, and I would say this is as a chooser, and then, thinking about how choice architects decide to put up the options, there always seems to be the very best choice. And then a chooser like me will say, I'm good with the next one down from the very best choice, because money, it plays a role in it. And I always say to myself, I don't need the top of the line. I'm good with the next best. And so talk a little bit about that sort of design, that architecture around the choice, presenting all these different options. How often do people, who are the people who will choose the best and who will settle for the next best?
So Lynn, you're asking essentially one of the first questions every designer should ask, which is how many options to represent the chooser? And, interestingly enough, you picked four or five, if I listened correctly, possibilities that somebody's decided we're going to offer you five different possible ski passes. And that's a really important decision. You can go way overboard. My favorite example is in the city of New York, kids pick high schools. To do this, they get a book that has 769 different high schools in it. No sane person thinks you're going to read the entire book. It's like an old school phone directory. So clearly that's too many. At the same time, there's another pressure to present enough so people have enough variety. As you say, not everyone is going to want the top of the line ski pass. So you're going to have to balance those two. I'd love to say the right answer is always three, and often people present three, but it depends upon how much variety there is and how much you know about the decision maker. If I, Lynn, knew you were always going to pick the second best, I'm going to present only the second best to you. So it's a really important decision that choice architects or designers need to make.
We as consumers or choosers, what is going on cognitively in our brains
And I know that it must happen differently for different people. I know that if I am deciding on purchasing a new dishwasher, it will take me weeks, whereas my husband can go on and see a couple dishwashers and he's made a decision in 20 seconds. And I think both of us fall on, we're like either end of the spectrum in terms of, you know, we both might be doing something wrong there.
One question I have for you is, who buys the better dishwasher? Or do you ever find out? And I assume there's a fight involved when it breaks down and one of you made the choice. There are differences in how much people like to search, and that's important. But also there are differences in how much the presentation. So let's go back to the menu example. You know, some people like menus that are many, many, many pages. Other people like menus that are four pages. But when given of complex menu, you're going to search more, whether you're your husband or you, Lynn. You basically, you know, the environment, the way you present choices, is going to change what you look at.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the trade-off for the New York City public schools, about how people make that decision with this thing that's the size of a phone book?
Well, think about, if you were given a choice like this, what are you going to do? You're going to simplify the choice. Even Lynn, who seems to be very, very motivated to make hard choices, we'll start looking at things like the person I talked about in the book, graduation rates. Mm-hmm. What is the percentage of kids who graduate? It turns out the person in the book who was a valedictorian of their grammar school said, I'm only going to look at high schools that have very high graduation rates. And sadly, New York, that value can be as low as 40%. Of all the students who enter as freshmen, only 40% graduate with degrees. So what he did is he looked at the ones that were the very best and just looked at only that, because that made the decision simpler for him. The problem is, by the time you get to the schools that graduate 99% of the students, they actually are very hard to get into. In fact, some of these schools in his top 10 list were, in fact, harder to get into than Harvard. So here he was, the valedictorian of his grammar school, and he ended up actually getting into none of his schools because there were so many options, he simplified. Let me give you one other example of that phenomena, which I love, although since I'm happily married, this is all research that I had other people do, dating sites. In a dating site, you have some dating sites, they tell me, dating sites like Tinder, you have an infinite number of options, and you're going to screen, look at one attribute, one feature, and that's usually the picture.
Right.
There are other sites that give you one person a day, and on those sites, people are much more likely to look at the personality, to look at other things. So even there, the number of options you present is going to change how you look at the options. You're going to essentially look at very different people on the two sites simply because someone, in this case, a designer, decided to give you Tinder. There's even a term, by the way, called Tinder thumb, which is the pain you feel by swiping left, swiping right. I mean, there are other consequences, but obviously that's a place where people change the way they choose depending upon how options are presented.
Mm-hmm. About 45 minutes from Park City, we have an international airport, the Salt Lake City Airport, and it's been completely redone. And I think the main reason for it was because it was sitting on a fault line where the sand gets liquefied. So they wanted to make sure it was ruggedized. Plus they had to expand it and modernize it. So we have this new airport, and I've had some folks that have come into town and I picked them up, and it seems that everybody that I pick up, they go to the wrong place to be picked up. And I would explain to them, oh, you have to do this, you have to do that. And then finally, this past Thanksgiving, I went away and somebody was picking me up for the first time at the airport. And I found that this thing was so confusing. They had so many signs in this airport, and they had where you get picked up for Uber, where you get picked up by a limousine. They weren't very clear about the passenger pickup. Sometimes these things can be very confusing. In a big public building like this, is there someone in charge of signs? I mean, there were different colored signs. There were different shaped signs. There were all these different choices, but it was very confusing.
I think it's a great example. And there, I think about other cases where simple changes, like putting a line down the middle of a hallway, actually changes how people walk. So your observation is exactly right.
Yeah.
And the question about who's in charge, the funny thing about choice architecture is that most people who are doing it don't realize it. And even if they do, they don't realize how effective it can be. So they're actually blind to this sort of almost superpower they have. So I suspect, of course, there's somebody in charge, but I don't think that person ever did something which I think would be very important, which is let's try some science and see how people like them. You know, let's actually do and ask the customer, is the sign clear or not?
Right.
It's part of blindness. We just think people think like us, and we think it really doesn't matter. And as you found out, it does.
And there's so much going on as far as testing. When you go to the online marketplace where they test different pictures, where they test how they present the colors and that sort of thing. I mean, those are the people that really understand the science and invest in it. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, if you think about, and one of my favorite sites to talk about is Netflix. And they invest, literally, they do hundreds of what they call A-B tests, which we'd call experiments, every day. So even things like the picture that's used to illustrate the movie, you know, is actually tested. I mean, they actually do, is this picture more effective than that picture? So they are the exception. Most of us walking around are ignorant of the impact of choice architecture, but people online who do lots of A-B testing, they actually know exactly what the outcome is. They may not have a theory of why it works, but they know that it does work.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Eric Johnson. He's written Elements of Choice, Why the Way We Decide Matters. And Eric, is you and John are talking about the Salt Lake City Airport. And by the way, I've had the same thing happen. I'm fascinated by the billions of dollars that they spent at that airport and still seem to have gotten this one really crucial element wrong. And so it makes me wonder how often there is no design or no choice architecture that we often wait for trial and error, which it seems like that's what's been done. It's a huge organization. Why do organizations not engage in choice architecture?
I think they're people. And so when they're choosers, they don't realize how influenced they are. I mean, if they had, the exception might be if they had to fly into the airport ahead of time and say, oh, this is confusing, they would get it. But by and large, I mean, it's very common. Let's think about government websites. We looked at the Obamacare sites that were, you know, the result of the Affordable Care Act. And we saw that people were very confused by those sites. And not that, you know, anyone is being mean or trying to, you know, sort of fool people. It's just they didn't realize how hard the task was and assume that if we gave people, I think in Utah, there's a huge number of options, you know, that they're going to be able to process it. And, you know, they just can't. They're more concerned with getting the website up than they were with getting the website to be something that people could use.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of websites, one of the things you talk about in your book is this thing that turns out to be very important. It's the font you use and also the size. But I've heard many people say, oh, can you believe they used that font from the 1950s, which in the 1950s, you know, fonts weren't really a topic, right? Now they are. Can you tell us why?
Well, I think the thing that's key is you make a decision early on when you make a choice about what to look at. It's almost more important to realize that when you're making a choice, you're deciding what to ignore as well as what to look at. And those choices are made not because we have a deep understanding of what's important, but because we find a font very ugly. So there are fonts, Hatchinweller, which is hard to pronounce as well as hard to read, which people will tend not to look at. And so if you want to make people care about price, for example, into your ski pass example, you'll present price in an easy to process way. You won't go, it's $12.95. You'd go, it's $12. If you want them not to look at price, you would probably put it in Hatchinweller and make it 12, you know, make it more complicated. So these very simple differences in how easy it is to read a piece of information determine what information people will look at.
And Eric, one of the examples in the book, which I really enjoyed, was when you were talking about doctors writing scripts, Allegra versus generic. Can you talk about the importance of the path of least resistance?
Yeah. So to continue on that frame, one of the things is, of course, when we're making choices, we often have to type something in. And so generics are typically cheaper, like five times cheaper than the brand name drug. And yet doctors tend to prescribe the non-generic, the brand name drug. So the example I use in the book is the antihistamine Allegra, which is essentially a dollar a pill, whereas generic is 20 cents a pill. Now, the reason it's important is not just to save hospitals money, but of course, if drugs are cheaper, people stick with the prescription, they comply. They don't take the pill every other day because they're going to run out. They actually take the drug, and it actually is important for them as well. Well, what these medical informaticists, I never knew that title existed, but the people who designed the electronic health records did was when you typed Allegra as a doctor, you would type A-L-L, it would fill out the generic name, which it turns out is fexafenidine hydrochloride. I had to practice a lot to be able to say that. But so did the doctors. They didn't remember the name, fexafenidine hydrochloride, but they did remember Allegra. They're easy to change back. There was one button they'd have to press to prescribe as directed, yet 90% of the doctors didn't change it. The reason they were prescribing what they did is because it was easy to remember, not because they thought it was genuinely better.
Right. As you researched this book, what most surprised you?
I think what most surprised me is the fact that people are as ignorant of choice architecture as they are. And what motivated me in part was finding out there are all these great things that could be done if you do the design job correctly. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, waste, money on the table, whatever phrase you want to use, that we could actually improve lots of outcomes by paying more attention to design, particularly choice architecture design.
Yeah, this book not only will help those who design, those who are the architectures, the architects of choice, but it, as choosers, it will help us be more aware and to become better choosers. I really love this topic so much. Eric Johnson, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
John and Lane, it's been great being with you. Thank you so much.